You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Monday, 25 May. U.S. markets are closed today for the Memorial Day holiday. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Jimmy Moyaha, Richemont results, not bad. I mean, look, what, eight odd billion in euros of cash, but are we still buying luxury? And if we've got a moment, Moody's gives us a slight upgrade. Chatting with Andreas van Heerden, CEO Afrimat, a really tough second half, weak iron ore prices and commodity write-downs. And then we'll be talking with our wealth manager from Private Client Holdings. Biggest risk to our wealth creation, not volatility, but behavior. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. No further fuel levy relief as Treasury rebalances books. Government's temporary intervention is expected to be phased out in the coming months. And business day, Taseko eyes JC listing after securing big Transnet rail allocation. Group considers a capital raise within 5 years to fund expansion across southern Africa. Morning markets, US was green on Friday, S&P and NASDAQ both 0.4% higher. The East is green, Sydney 1.1% higher, Tokyo 2.9%. Hong Kong is closed for birthday of the Buddha and Tencent up 0.6%. Commodities, mostly green. Gold futures, 4,595. Brent is the red, 98.23. Platinum, 1,972. And palladium, unchanged, 1,410. Rand is 1,634. Bitcoin, 76,900. And top 40 opening call, a green open, 1,330 points, or 1.25% higher.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Jimmy Moyaha. Jimmy, appreciate the early morning time. Friday, Richemont results coming through for the year end. I mean, not a bad set of numbers. I mean, I'm always, you know, at $22 billion in sales. That's up 11% constant rates. I mentioned, what is it, 8.5 billion euros sitting cash in the bank, generating 4.9. Lots to like. Your take on numbers. Are we still buying luxury?
Good morning, Simon. I think the numbers speak for themselves. With till sales going north of 420 billion rands, there's 420 billion reasons why people are still in looking at luxury. The one thing we must remember about the luxury space and the high net worth market is they're less worried about what happens in the fuel market as we are. They're not impacted by oil prices. They're worried about whether or not they can refuel their yachts and buy their nice luxury goods. Richemont, for all it's worth as a business, has been doing exceptionally well, even in trying times. We've seen that that business has grown from being a sort of entry-level luxury business to really competing with or competing on the levels of the LVMHs of the world. That business has really acquired some good strategic assets. There's some units, obviously, within the business, like the watchmaking business, that did see a bit of a decline over the last year. But to still close out the year with more than 100 billion rands worth of net profits is something that the business is clearly showing that they're managing to survive and weather these storms. So I think it's very interesting to see that luxury as itself as a sector isn't performing the same as some of the other sectors. But it could also be the fact that with all of the uncertainty in the global markets, those that have historically looked to markets like gold, like luxury, are still going back to what it is that they know, given that life may be shorter than what we previously anticipated. A lot has changed since the pandemic,
It has, but I like your point. People who are buying Cartier watches are not worried about the price of petrol or diesel or whatever the case may be. It is of no concern to them. They continue to buy their luxury watches. So let's go to Moody's. Moody's is typically late to the party. I'm reminded that S&P and Fitch downgraded us to junk status in 2017. Moody's only did it in 2020 when we were in the pandemic. However, they have quite quickly come and said, not an upgrade, but that we have a positive outlook, which is maybe a move to start moving us higher, although a long way to get back to investment grade and out of the junk status.
Absolutely. If this has taught us one thing as a country and as an economy, is that it is far easier to get thrown further down the ladder than it is to come up the ladder. So very, very easy to be downgraded, very difficult to come back into upgrade status. But to the credit of South Africa and what we've been able to achieve, the reforms that came through, particularly those that came through towards the latter part of 2025, those really boosted the global sentiment around the South African story to show that South Africa is capable of the reforms. We'd previously been accused of not being able to get our debt under control, of continuously bailing out state-owned entities, of having a myriad of problems, many of which we are still contending with, or contending with the impacts thereof. But that does not necessarily mean that we are not on the right trajectory and on the right path. The real question here, and this is why we have yet to be upgraded by any of the ratings agencies, is: are these reforms sustainable in the sense that are we going to be able to continue to meet those reforms? It's easy to say we'll do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for the short period of time and then stop doing those things. I think the ratings agencies, whether we agree on their biases or not, would be looking for a lot more consistency than just temporary changes. You're seeing that across all of the ratings agencies and how they view all of the markets, really.
Yeah, I get your point in that. And it is, I like the fact, yeah, it's easy to fall down the rabbit hole. It's a whole lot slower to actually work our way back up. Jimmy Moyoha, independent analyst, appreciate the early morning time. The Standard Flexible Income Fund delivers capital preservation and consistent top quartile inflation-beating returns. Let your money keep working with Standard Asset Management even after you retire.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
I'm chatting with Andreas van Heerden. He's the CEO at Afrimat. Results year in Feb, revenue up 20.3%, EPS up 32.5%, and a dividend of 13 cents. Andreas, appreciate the time. You make it quite clear in your results that this really was a year of two halves. In H1, you did almost 102 cents. H2, you did a negative 6 cents. And this is mostly in Nkomati.
Yeah, Simon, the impact of the ferrochrome, the closure of the ferrochrome smelters on Nkomati was quite severe. That brought that mine almost to a grind. Well, it actually operationally did bring it to a grinding halt, although we still exported some of this from the stockpiles. And it forced us to, you know, just rethink the whole business model there. And we decided to really downsize the mine, which led to an impairment of 118 million rand because we closed the underground working. So Nkomati was really the main reason for the negative second half.
And I mean, you mentioned you've been doing some exports instead. Has there been any sales in H2 or any of these ferrochrome mines coming back?
No, in the second half of the year, it was purely exports and at an actually relatively low price.
Okay, yeah. You said before that the exports are not so great. Hey, also, I mean, iron ore, let's touch on that. Lower profitability, still profitable, but here we have both a volume and price issues.
Yes, so if we look at the profit contribution from our iron ore business, you know, in total we had 605 million rand for the year, but in the first half that was 403, and the second half is 200. So literally halved in the second half, and there were two major factors. The one is on the domestic front, the AMSA's demand really diminished from December, January, February. They had a very low demand, which had an impact. And then on the international market, we saw the rand value of the iron ore price, that came down quite a lot with the rand strengthening, the dollar price coming down. It was quite a number of factors that actually worked against the price. So the combination of the two made that the iron ore business had a much smaller contribution in the second half.
Yeah. And Nkomati, as you said, they're right down there. That obviously hurts the numbers, but that's not a cash entry. That's an accounting issue. Cash flow's recovering. I mean, and you're pulling back some costs, particularly Lafarge with the integration that's happening there. And cash flow's definitely going in the right direction.
Yes, absolutely. We saw a very nice improvement in cash flow for the year. It could have been better. Because of the sudden slowdown in demand in the bulk commodities businesses, We were sitting with a lot of excess stock at the end of the financial year, which would otherwise have been turned into cash. So there was potential for more, but things going in the right direction. And given that the Lafarge business is now fully integrated and we managed to engineer quite a lot of cost out of the structure, you know, things are really improving on the cash flow front.
And the construction materials, it had a good period. I mean, it did well. Some good numbers coming out of there.
Yes, the reason why we bought Lafarge in the first place was we were after the aggregates business, yeah. The quarries, because Lafarge had some of the very best quarries in South Africa. And, you know, making that part of our portfolio really bolstered our aggregates business, the quarrying business around the country. So unfortunately, the cement business, which is actually still a relatively small part of the Lafarge business, mm-hmm. You know, that was still not profit making, but the quarries and the fly ash business more than that made up for what we lost in the cement.
I want to touch on Transnet. Obviously, your iron ore goes via Transnet. You mentioned that you've got an 870,000-ton allocation. You don't get the full amount, but are you seeing an improvement from Transnet?
Most definitely. We've seen, since the new management has taken over, it's been a consistent improvement, and you know their reliability has improved. Unfortunately, due to the huge backlog in maintenance,
yeah.
We will see two shutdowns this year, where other years we only saw one, which will have an impact on total volumes moved. But you know, when that system works, it's becoming a lot more reliable than where it was a while back.
Last question around energy costs. This is obviously post-period end. I imagine you must be quite a significant user of diesel.
Yes, we used last year. We used about 27 million tons of liters of of diesel. This year, we have managed to reduce our consumption a little bit through some efficiency programs mm-hmm. that we've done over the time. But we still use a good 2 million liters a month. So yeah, the current increase does have a cost impact, and some of it we can pass on into the market, but some of it, especially in the bulk commodities, we have to absorb.
Yeah, and that diesel has been, I mean, it's been an absolute shocker to the price. A bit of a pullback apparently expected in June. We'll hold thumbs for that. But we'll leave it there. Andreas van Heerden, CEO, Afrimat. Always appreciate the time. Give your money the return at once without taking a flight with the Stanlib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Mark Matsaman. He is a wealth manager, private client holdings. Mark, appreciate the early morning time. Market volatility. In a recent piece you put out, you talk around it being the sort of price of admission to the investment system. In essence, I mean, volatility is, it's a feature. It's not a bug. Notwithstanding, for many investors, we seriously dislike it and we struggle with that volatility.
Yeah, good morning, Simon, and good morning to your listeners. I think investors have had to deal with a fair amount over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, COVID pandemic seems like it was just yesterday. Then we had the poly crisis in 2022, Trump's Liberation Day last year, and this year we've had to deal with the US-Iran war. And these market events have been characterized by fairly steep drawdowns and I guess fairly swift recoveries. But we're exposed to market movements constantly now. You know, 20 years ago, clients saw a quarterly statement, and today they can check their portfolios every hour on their phone. And in Gloria Marks' book, Simon, in attention span, she highlights that adult attention spans have declined by roughly 2/3. And that matters because investing requires patience, yet the world increasingly rewards immediacy. You know, the average holding period of equities has fallen dramatically over the decades. Mm-hmm.
I like your point around that. Sorry to jump in, but it's a really great point. I hadn't thought about it. Back in the day, I used to check the market performance with the morning newspaper. Literally, that was it. I mean, maybe I'm thinking the crash of 87 maybe made the lunchtime news, but it was a once a day process. And for many people, it was not even once a day. It was less frequent. Now it is on my phone 24/7. That's stressing me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, investors have all of this data, all of this information at their fingertips. And, you know, we see it with clients. There's certain clients that will check information very regularly, if not, as I said, multiple times on a daily basis. And when you think about it, you know, over the years, the average holding period of equities has fallen dramatically, as I mentioned earlier. Yeah. You know, investing is a patience game. And the reality is that, you know, there are market movements out there. You know, whilst high frequency machine trading, algorithmic trading, systematic trading, they almost amplify the short term noise. And then there's some really fascinating behavioral research at the moment, which shows that the more often people observe their investments, the more volatility they perceive, and the more emotionally uncomfortable it becomes, which ultimately leads to poor long term decision making. Behavioral scientists effectively call this thin slicing. But then when we add social media, 24-hour financial news, instant commentary, it all creates a sense of urgency. But at the end of the day, not every market move deserves action.
I mean, agreed. I mean, I would wager that most market moves don't deserve action, and that for the average investor, we are better served looking at the market less. We think it's giving us an edge. We're actually better putting the phone down, turning it off, and going back to that quarterly statement. Heck, an annual statement.
Yeah, 100%. At the end of the day, we're all human, and we're all exposed to, I guess, a degree of discomfort, especially when it comes to money. And money is an emotional aspect for most people. And there's this behavioral bias, and it's a horrible one because it's asymmetric. You know, it's not a perfect trade-off. It's an asymmetric trade-off, and it's called loss aversion. And what it means is that for many people, losing 100,000 Rand emotionally hurts far more than gaining 100,000 feels good. Mm. And so when markets fall sharply, selling feels like taking control, but emotionally comforting decisions often, you know, financially damaging. And so many people have this inclination, and they do. They sell after declines and reinvest after recoveries. And in effect, what they're doing is they're buying high and selling low.
Yeah. And this then comes, and this is a point I've made before on this show, is that for the advisor, your biggest point of value from a wealth manager is that kind of keeping me on the straight and narrow. It's stopping me doing things perhaps more than anything.
Yeah, and I think that changes over time. So it's not always the case. So during calm periods, structuring, asset allocation, investment selection matters, right? Mm-hmm. But during volatile periods, those events which I had mentioned earlier, we focus on helping clients stay disciplined often, and that often matters more. So in difficult markets, we become part strategist, part behavioral coach, part emotional sounding board. And I guess I'm less interested in predicting the next correction, because I can't, than helping clients prepare for one when it arrives. And there's a lot of good communication that takes place during those, let's say, more volatile periods.
Yeah.
And the communication with clients is that it's not about when there will be a recession or when there will be a downturn. It's how do we respond? How do we react? How do we behave when it does happen? And then crucially, you know, it's important to set expectations around volatility. You know, most portfolios, and let's take a multi-managed sort of high equity fund, for example, 4 or 5 months during the year, that fund is going to be down. The other 6 or 7 times, it's going to be up. But just giving an idea of that risk return signature is incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like that. It's how to respond. We know it'll happen. We don't know when it'll happen, but we can learn how to respond as markets fall, because they do. I mean, sure, they spend more time going up than down, but they spend a lot of time going down as well. We'll leave it there, Mark. Mark Simon, he's a wealth manager at Private Client Holdings. Appreciate the early morning time. That's it for today. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobukle, Nicole, Sabu, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. 500 million Rand for renewable energy.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.